So first off, I'd like to thank you for coming today. I realize that your schedule must be really tight since your new book just came out, God of Misconnections. And it was great attending your launch at the Heritage Hall on May 5th, where God of Misconnections was one of four books being launched by Vancouver Writers. So you were first published when you were 24, and your first book, Curio, was published when you were 29. Have you always known you want to be a writer, and do you want to talk a little bit about how you got into poetry?
Sure. I think writers get this question a lot. When did they start writing? And I'm one of those people who started really, really young. I remember when I was a kid, before I could even write words, I used to make a little book and just write put lines on the page that would pretend that they were text. So it goes way back, the writing. Yeah. I really started seriously writing, I think, rather than just in my journal as a teenage scribbler. Probably when I was 20, 21 years old. And I started, I decided that I could either study music or I could study writing. I couldn't do both, so I decided to study writing and went from there.
Did you read a lot of poetry when you were younger? Was there anyone that had a lasting impression on you, either because of your affinity or disdain for their work?
The first book of poetry that I remember reading is a book that my mom had on the shelf, and it was called A Book of Good Poems, and it was a textbook from when she was in high school in Regina, and it had poems from T.S. Eliot, and I guess Emily Dickinson was in there as well, among other writers, and I remember really enjoying that book a lot, and reading it and rereading it, and also the poetry of Robert Service. That was on the shelf as well. We weren't huge readers in my house, but there were a couple of books that I seem to remember reading. So Robert Service, of course, we had on the shelf because I spent some summers in the Yukon. My dad is a bush pilot, so so we would go up there and live with him, and he would fly the geologists around. And, of course, we came home with Robert Service. So those kind of silly ballads have really stayed with me for sure. But would I say that I have an affinity with any of those writers? Well, certainly T.S. Eliot and Emily Dickinson. And I love reading Robert Service because it's fun, but I don't know if I'm like, just crazy about that poetry. But certainly T.S. Eliot and Emily Dickinson. Emily Dickinson is one of those writers that I have been sort of bashing my eyeballs against for lots of years, and I think there's a lot more for me to discover in her work than I already have. T.S. Eliot, on the other hand, it's been just very important for me. I turned his long poem, The Wasteland, into the anagrams, which was a really intense project, and really got to know that poem particularly well. So
that was in Curio.
Yeah, that's in Curio. Yeah, there you go. So yes.
And have you seen a shift in your appreciation for poetry over the years? And your taste in it has changed in any way?
I'm a particularly open reader. I enjoy all sorts of different types of poetry. I guess there are things that I appreciate more now than I might have when I was younger. I'm trying to think of something in particular. Well, Emily Dickinson.
Yeah.
She
stayed with you.
Yeah, well, I think her work is always a mystery to me, so you can keep reading it and reading it. And
so compact.
Very compact and very complicated. So I keep enjoying that work. I'm trying to think of poets that I am less interested in now than I used to be when I was younger. And I think that would be more like, it's hard to say, maybe the Beats. I used to really the Beats when I was a teenager or a young writer.
Yeah.
That sort of swaggering type of verse.
Boundless energy.
Sure. Yeah. And I think I'm less interested in that than I used to be. Which is not to say, of course, that some Beat poetry isn't wonderful, because it is. But yeah, there.
So there's a great focus today on writer's method, and how would you describe your own? What is usually the stimulus behind a poem? Does it begin with an idea or with a language, like a phrase or a few words? Or,
well, again, I'm a wide reader, and I'm also my practice is very varied.
Mm-hmm.
So it really depends on the type of work that I'm working on. I've written a lot of procedural verse, mm-hmm. where the form of the piece precedes the content. And then I have books like God of Misconnections where really the content is what is driving that project. So I had to find the vessel for that particular material to, you know, to fill. I wasn't sure what it was going to look like before I started. So I guess to be more specific, you know, poems in God of Misconnections really began with lines, images, certain stories that I wanted to tell. I did a lot of research for that book, so a lot of the poems in this book sprang from the research. There's a lot of found material in God of Misconnections, so I'm actually just reusing stuff that other people have written and changing it or riffing on that. There are quite a bit of metrical verse in God of Misconnections as well, so that gave shape to some of the more amorphous ideas that were going on there. I love to write sonnets. I particularly love to write sonnets, so that's a form that I continue to return to. I find it really satisfying. I love that it's so condensed and that you can say so much in such a small space. And it's always a surprising type of poem to write, because although you know which expectations you're going to fulfill, you never really know how you're going to fulfill them until you get into that space. So I really like writing sonnets. But there's also games. I've written so many games too, where I'm not worried at all about what I say in the poems, but rather how I say it. So, you know, things like the anagrams and the palindromes and noun games that I played in Curio were a lot of fun and were really important for sort of like building your chops when you're a young writer, you know, sort of like doing your scales. See what you can do with not a lot.
Yeah. Do you want to talk about a little bit about the games that you have used to write some of the poems in Curio? It's really interesting.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I guess my favorite games in Curio are, certainly the anagrams. Those were probably my favorite games. So, of course, for people who can't remember, an anagram is a word or a phrase that you rearrange all the letters in that word or phrase to. Read is another line, and so star becomes rat, or tars, or
tar, yeah.
Yeah, arts. So for example, the first line of Milton's On His Blindness, which is one of the poems in the book, begins, "When I consider how my light is spent," that's Milton's line, and my line becomes, "Dim, nephritic, yet single, whoosh." So it's kind of silly, and it's, but it's fun and a little bit, what's the word?
Innovative.
Well, I was thinking more like bad. Like, it just feels like wrong and bad. A little bit illegal. Like, Milton would just roll over in his grave if he knew what I was doing. And so it felt a little transgressive that way. So I think that was exciting for me to take poems that were so revered and then to just turn them right on their head. I really like doing that. So those were super fun. And the Wasteland, the long anagram, it took me 3 years to write it.
Oh, wow.
It was a really long project because I could barely face it. It was such a big, you know, thing to do, a line by line like that. And so I would take a run at it. And for a couple of weeks, I'd just do that every day. Like, go to the desk and stay there for hours. And really, it just felt like going to the factory, you know, because I've had that kind of work where you go and it seemed like the work
ethic. Labor at it.
Yeah, it's real labor, you know. It seems like there's something about the work ethic to that kind of writing where you just, it's your bum in your seat and you get there and you're just like, you know, you got to do it. You have to do it. It will never be done unless you put the work in. So that was interesting too, that it had this sort of plebeian quality to it, you know. Anybody could do that. It would just take the desire and the time and the, whatever that it becomes. So, yeah, I really liked doing those projects, and I liked how they looked afterward. I love how they sound. I love to read them. Mm-hmm. The palindromes, which are poems which read the same way forwards as they do backwards, those were also really challenging and interesting to work with, because of syntax, you have to really think about how you can make your lines flexible you know, deciding where to put your punctuation. Words that mean more than one thing, of course, are key for that kind of writing. Mm-hmm. So you can change meaning so that, you know, when you say it one way, it's one thing. And then when you say it another, it's another. So that was really fun to try and think about language in that way, to see the flexibility of language, how it can really work for you. And the other games in that book, I'm trying to remember now, I'm looking through. I had poems, I think it's called The Alchemist. Yeah, The Alchemist, that section. That section is all based on Lisa Robertson's book, The Apothecary. And what I did with this is I just, you know, all of the poems in The Apothecary seemed to me to have, they were very formally strict. They had five lines, they were prose poetry, they were often just one sentence, and it seemed to me that many of those poems were, the sense of the poem was less important than the sound of the poem. And of course, Lisa Robertson is rather oblique on occasion, so I really wanted to explore that type of writing. So I basically just wrote my own version of the Apothecary, and so there you go. I again, taking something that already exists and turning it into something else. It is very, very similar yet very different.
And I know you teach creative writing at Douglas College right now. So do you ever use any of these games as a stimulus for like class projects or assignments?
I do lead my students through games in mm-hmm. the classroom. I don't use these exact games, but I do use some others. I use, this is fairly common, but we play noun games where I have the students generate a list of nouns, and then we take the nouns and you have to use them in a 10-minute period in your free write. So that's always interesting in getting students out of the problem of writing sort of more autobiographical work, which is of course seems to be where so many people start, right? They're writing mm-hmm. from their experience. So to get them away from that a little bit and get them thinking about poetry as a made thing rather than something that's coming from this mysterious place.
It's a common misconception too, especially mistaking the speaker for the poet.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm sure you get that a lot probably, especially with Homo Southern Service. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, I do. Yeah. I'm always having to remind people that it's fiction. Yeah. Or it's made up. You can make stuff up. You don't have to be the characters in your work. Which is not to say that we can't use stuff from our lives as fodder, certainly.
Yeah.
A lot of writers do. I do. But it's not me. Yeah. Yeah.
What do you think it is about poetry that, you know, when it's a fiction, when it's like a work of fiction, people don't usually assume that the author is, you know, the character, but something about poetry, you have that almost automatic connection. What do you think it is about poetry in particular that makes people think that?
Well, there's an economy of language that gets ideas across quickly to other people in poetry. It can't. Mm-hmm. Not, you know, that possibility is heightened with poetry. And there is an intimate quality to poetry and an expectation that people have of poetry to fulfill intimacy. And it's interesting, you know, people do connect with the work, but that's very revealing to me. It tells me a lot about readers rather than about maybe myself. So much, you know. I feel very fortunate when people come and talk to me about being connected to anything I've written. I think, wow, that's a real honor to have had people come up to me and talk to me that way. Just recently, I was in Edmonton for a poetry festival, and this woman came up to me after the reading. Well, actually, sorry, she sent me an email after the reading, and she was saying that one of the poems in God of Misconnections, which depicts a famine in Ukraine, or the famine in Ukraine, 1932-33, which is called Holodomor, her father lived through this famine mm-hmm. and was just screwed up like his whole life about it, and she thanked me for the poem, and she said that I'd gotten it right, whatever that means, right?
Yeah.
You got it right. And so I figured I was done. Like, after I read that email, I was like, well, I can put that book to bed now.
Yeah.
That is fine. That's enough. Like, that,
oh, wow.
You know, that someone could have that kind of connection with the work. I guess it was surprising. Yeah. Right? So I feel pretty okay about that. And similarly, people from different parts of Canada and the American Midwest, for some reason, seems to be like a hotspot for Liz Pachinsky, but it's bizarre, right? Get fan mail from Minnesota. But yeah, people really love, the people out there really love Homestead and Service,
yeah.
and those kids and how they grew up. And yeah, and even just recently, who was it? Someone from Eastern Europe contacted me and was like, you know, I'm reading Homestead and Service. I'm like, first off, how? Did you get it? And secondly, wow. And she was saying that even though the kids out there are like a completely different culture, a completely mm-hmm. different place, that she found connections there. So I was just like, it's weird, you know. There we have like these great, you know, human experiences, I think, that that transcend culture. So that's exciting too, to see that. But yeah. Always very honored when people contact me in that way. Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Is that the most fulfilling part of doing your job?
Yeah.
Well, after it's completed, I guess, after the process is done.
Sure, yeah. Sure. Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Yeah, I'm always amazed. You know, I meet so many amazing people, and I feel so fortunate to be able to travel a little bit and talk to those people and share my work. I feel like it's a great privilege. So there you go. It's wonderful. Yeah, really.
Yeah, it's great to be able to enjoy your job so much.
I do.
Yeah.
I do. Me and my dad, we share it. He's a pilot, I mentioned before, and every time he comes to visit me, he lives in Hull Beach, which is on the northern tip of Baffin Island, and whenever he comes to visit me, he says, I'm so lucky, you know, I get to go to work every day, and I love what I do, and so we share that, for sure. Yeah.
And so how do you feel about teaching poetry? Do you feel the same way about teaching as you do about writing?
I do.
Yeah?
Yeah, I really do. I love my students. I think that they're interesting, they're engaged, they're curious, they're excited, they're ebullient, they often my students are young, so they're coming to poetry with not a lot of expectation,
mm-hmm.
Or at least not, you know, they have ideas about what poetry is, but they've never really put those ideas into practice, so it's exciting, you know, you get to see them grow and change throughout semesters, and yeah, it's wonderful, it's really wonderful.
So, I guess you're a believer that you can teach poetry.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I am. I can't teach students what to write about,
mm-hmm.
but I can teach them how to go about it in a few different ways. You know, I won't. Yeah, I guess that's the mystery part of poetry, is really the content. You know, you can't really teach people how to think or how to process information. But you can teach them ways to go about it, rather than, yeah. So I never prescribe subjects to my students. So we play with language more than we do with ideas. Or maybe it's both. I don't know.
So would you say, like, when you're teaching, you go about the process, the process begins with each student's writing, as opposed to this is what you're supposed to do when you're writing. Like, do you have books that, like, teach how to write, you know, the, like, Anne Lamott books and the Natalie Goldberg books that are, like, writing down the bones? Do you use material like that, or does it just begin with each student's individual work?
Usually in the classroom, it starts with the student's work. I like to see what it is that they're doing so that I can, you know, because we're all individuals, right? Each person in my classroom is going to have a different strength or a different area that they're going to be interested in. So I try to take a look at what they're doing before I give them any ideas about how they might go about doing it. And I think that that's a pretty good place to start, because then you're not prescribing right away, and you're not shutting people off or shutting them down. You're just saying, okay, well, how about this direction? You might be interested in this or that. So But, you know, once I've seen the direction that students might like to go in, I'll use Natalie's work, sure, totally. Or Kenneth Koch has some great exercises that are a lot of fun. What else do I like to use? Well, I guess, you know, I look also to poets. Mm-hmm. You know, I say, okay, well, let's try and write a poem I'm trying to think of a good example. Poems that I've actually used in classroom. Well, we write instructional poems. I get students to teach me how to do something that they know how to do really well. That's a very fruitful exercise. It gets people out of themselves a little bit.
Yeah.
And of course, a sonnet. The second you throw a sonnet at students, all kinds of interesting accidents happen, which is pretty wonderful. So. Yeah.
I guess the best work comes out of the accidents.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about your new book, Bottomless Connections.
Sure.
So in one of the first poems, in Goddess of Safe Travel, I think that might be actually the first poem of the book.
Yeah.
You talk about history and say, because to plow it, you've got to own it. Mm. And I was just wondering what it means for you in relation to your own history.
To plow it, you've got to own it. Well, a couple of things. First off, we're on First Nations land. I really like to ponder that question mm-hmm. quite a bit. You know,
you tell the reader to ponder it.
absolutely. I'm like, I don't know what that could mean to you, but I know what it means. I know what it means to me. And, so I'm very conscious of that. The mm-hmm. fact that, Canada, is not Canada. And then secondly, of course, that my ancestors are immigrants. So, and the context of, like, what kind of immigrants my family was. Of course, we're all Ukrainian-Canadian, and we have some Irish history as well. So when we came here, the colonists said, okay, all of you Ukrainians, you're getting on a train, and you're going out to the prairies, and we're going to kick you out, and the land that you land on is basically the land that you will develop.
Mm-hmm.
So they were giving land away. People out there in cyberspace cannot hear my quotes around giving land away, but I'm putting them there. And so Ukrainian families did own land, and they did develop it, and they did have homesteads. And but of course, it wasn't very good land. It was pretty rugged. And I don't know. I like to think about hierarchies and how the goods are distributed in any situation. So yeah. Also, I don't own anything. You know, I'm a renter. I live in Vancouver, which is the most expensive city in the country to live, and I don't know if I'll ever own anything here. So yeah, I think about money a lot. I think about who's got money, who doesn't have money, what that looks like. I guess all of that is really packed into that one particular phrase. So it's very considered. Yeah. It's a very considered phrase. So yeah, there you go.
Yeah, that's interesting, because when I read it, I was thinking just about your heritage, your Ukrainian heritage, but there's so much more in that phrase. And I was reading in the postscript of your book, you said you were one of the people of your generation who was unaware of some basic history of both the old country and new, and you know, you were born in Regina, and you grew up in Prince George, and you're, of course, of Ukrainian descent, and I was just wondering what is it now that spurred your curiosity to explore a cultural identity? Is there something that incited this recently, or...?
Sure. Well, about 5 years ago, my girlfriend Trish Kelly called me up, and she was like, hey, how are things going in the homeland? And I was like, what are you talking about? That is ridiculous. Yeah. I'm in my homeland.
Yeah.
And so she really got me thinking. And I realized that I didn't know how anything
just
was
that
going.
One question.
Yeah. How things were going. It was just, I mean, there was a big blank there.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always been really interested in the culture of my family. My parents met at a Ukrainian dance camp in Musiman, Saskatchewan. They're dancers, they're performers, they're singers. My grandfather is a musician. Just a really active family in that way. So it's always been part of our family. Also food. You know, that's often the thing that even through the generations will get passed on. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, we do Ukrainian Christmas. I can make all that food, which it seems incongruous sometimes that you can have that connection. So really, you know, the instinct was there to look into that type of stuff. But then when I started doing the research, I was just floored by how much I didn't know. And also, you know, really key cultural events, you know, the fact that, again, between 2.5 and 10 million Ukrainian people starved to death in 1932-33 in eastern Ukraine. I mean, that's enormous, right? Why wouldn't we have heard about that? Well, of course, we didn't hear about it because no information was coming out of that part of the world until quite recently. And internment camps in Canada during the First World War, 6,000 Ukrainian Canadians were interned in what is now our national park system. You know, that just seems wild to me that isn't part of the history of Canada, you know. Not in the books anyway, not in the books that I read when I was a kid. So yeah, my research was really eye-opening for me. Especially eye-opening, you know, in thinking about how this country was built and on whose labor. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's pretty important to me. I'm really glad that I wrote the book.
So how did you, do you want to talk a little bit about the research and how you went about tracing your roots and just researching? There's so much, I know, especially the poem, the Wax Ceremony, there's, you were saying lots of like found material and...
For sure. Yeah. Well, it was really hard.
Yeah.
There are a ton of textbooks out there. I actually wanted to put the whole bibliography at the back of the book, but my publisher was like, it's a bit crazy, like it's a bit much. So, yeah, if people are interested in seeing that bibliography, I'm very happy to share it with them. They just have to go through my publisher. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, I just started just collecting books. I'd go to secondhand bookstores and anything that I could find that had, you know, the word Ukrainian-Canadian in the title or would explore that subject, I would grab it. So a lot of first-person accounts of early settlers in Canada, a lot of textbooks from the... CIUS, it's the Canadian Institute of Ukrainian Studies. I have a ton of textbooks from them. I was lucky I got to go to the University of Alberta for a reading, and that's of course where they have an office, so I was able to get a whole bunch of books from there, including The Word in Wax, which is Rena Jean Hanchuk's amazing book with the incantations that are throughout the book, which are fascinating. They're just really wild. So yeah, I just gathered and gathered and gathered until I had a lot of books, and then I just started reading. And yeah, I think the most important books, though, if people really want some books that are gonna give them some very interesting information, would be No Streets of Gold by Helen Potrebenko, who's an amazing storyteller, and I really love her work. Also, of course, Myrna Kostash is All of Baba's Children. It's very interesting. And there's a book called In the Shadow of the Rockies, which I use a lot of found material from in the Wax Ceremony. All that weather stuff that you see, that's all from the logbook that was kept at Castle Mountain, the Castle Mountain internment camp. And so it's just really banal, kind of, you know, work continued as usual, work continued as usual, work continued, and then lots of weather. Again, Lisa Robertson, I love her work. A little bit of a nod to her as well. But... yeah, so you just reading.
Yeah. How about within your own family? Did you start asking a lot of questions and, like, learning about the family history? Or was that not as big a part of it as the research?
That's certainly a part of it.
Yeah.
You know, my parents really are the place where I went to for a lot of information about our family. But, again, you know, part of the missed connections is that, you know, my family, my parents were born in the prairies in Regina and Winnipeg, where there's a big Ukrainian community. And when I was 4 years old, we moved to Prince George, northern British Columbia. And apparently there are a lot of Ukrainians living up in Prince George now, but I don't remember there being a big Ukrainian community there when I was growing up. And so that really wasn't part of our culture. Our culture was really the culture of... pilots and geologists and loggers and, you know, that, you know, my school, my music, I used to play violin. So that was really what the stuff that stuck was music, dancing, singing, all that kind of stuff, that stayed. But
The arts.
Yeah, the arts stayed, but anything that would have been a little bit more, I don't know, just like everyday kind of stuff, mm-hmm. not so much. Like, I found out stuff about my family that was fascinating. In fact, that we were all card-carrying communists. That's pretty interesting, you know, that they were part of the labor movement, that, I don't know, that my, that some of my great aunties were, worked for Holt Renfrew as, in the Schmatze business, you know, like, just really, it's just interesting, you know, like, how can you, I just had no idea. So that's pretty fascinating. Yeah. It was really worthwhile looking into, and of course there's so much more to find out as well. Yeah. Yep.
So how much was Ukrainian part of your identity, you know, growing up? Would you consider yourself like, oh, I'm a Ukrainian Canadian, or especially when you're like a kid, you just want to assimilate and
sure.
you just want to blend in and you don't want to stand out and.
Sure. I definitely always thought that the Ukrainian part of our family was pretty important. I remember, because I grew up during the 80s, you remember, which is sort of like the last big hurrah for multiculturalism in Canada. Mm-hmm. It was like the word on everybody's lips. And I remember in grade 2, they had like multicultural days at our elementary school, Meadow Elementary, which is now a medical clinic in Prince George. But that's another book. But so, yeah, and they made us all come and bring different types of food to school, you know, or, like, ethnic cuisine. And then I also remember coming to school in my little Ukrainian dancer outfit and that kind of stuff. So, yeah, I think back to that, and I think it's actually kind of celebrated a little bit that we were all different cultures. Of course, everybody was up there and is all over. So, yeah, it has always been present in my life for sure. But I hear what you're saying about the whole assimilation thing. Like, I think, you know, our generation is pretty lucky in that there isn't a lot of racism associated with, you know, being Ukrainian these days, I don't think. Although, certainly, yeah, there are moments. So, yeah, previous generations were not so fortunate.
And there's an interesting epigraph in your book by Andrei Bitov. Mm-hmm. It says, they, the young people, have forgotten as much as they learned and how much they have forgotten in vain. And I was wondering if that's about young people not knowing their own histories?
Certainly.
Yeah.
Certainly. Yeah. Absolutely.
And I just, do you think that young people are interested in their histories and if they should be? And
I do think that. But I think, you know, it's hard to forget something that you never knew. Mm-hmm. So if those stories aren't being told in your family for whatever reason, you know, censure or lack of interest or fear or, you know, xenophobia, whatever reason, it's hard to feel particularly guilty about not knowing those stories because no one ever told them to you. So really the work is upon young people to ask questions and say, okay, well, why do we do things this way? We've always done, you know, we always use this kind of flower. We always use this kind of ceremony at dinner or whatever. You know, you gotta say, like, why are we doing this? And be curious. I think there's the only thing that will kill culture extremely, extremely quickly is a lack of curiosity. Mm-hmm. And, of course, curiousness means that you have to care.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, I'm asking young people to care, to be curious.
Yeah. So in that way, do you think, I was going to say, like, how do you feel this collection fits in or differs from or adds to the, like, Canadian immigrant experience, even though you're many generations, Ukrainian, Canadian, just in general, do you think it's representative of all immigrants or like different generation?
I actually don't think that. Just recently I was talking to a cabbie who was from Ethiopia, and he was saying, because we were talking about the book and he was really curious about it, and he was like, oh, you know, it's like it's really good that you're writing this book, that you're so interested in your ancestors, and he's like, yeah, you gotta keep doing that work, it's really important. He says, but you know, I'm so lucky because, you know, I just moved here 12 years ago, and, you know, you can't say those things anymore. You can't say, like Stephen Leacock, there's a quote in there. Where is it? I'll read it. I'll see if I can find it. It's an unbelievable quote. It's a good example of this tough story I just wrote.
Is it about the proletariat?
No, it's, where is it? Oh, here it is. It says, a little dose of them, meaning Ukrainians, may even in variation do good, like a minute dose of poison in medicine. I am not saying we should absolutely shut out and debar the European foreigner as we should and do the Oriental, but we should in no way facilitate his coming. And that's Stephen Leacock in 1930. You can't say that stuff anymore. And so, yeah, Cabby was right. Things have changed. Yeah. You know, there are laws, there are protections for people who come to Canada these days. And, you know,
it's an insane quote.
It's a totally insane quote, right? And it just reminds you, like, how easy would it be to go back to a place where this kind of thing happens? Like, I think it's not that hard, you know, if you really think about it. It's really what we're willing to allow and what we're not willing to allow. Yeah. And so, I don't know. I guess maybe that's really where this book resides in regards to that question, which is, you know, it's asking, like, what would it take to go back to that place? And I think part of what it takes is to not be curious and to not ask questions and to forget that, in fact, we all came to this country and we, you know, need to be aware of that. So, yeah. That's a long answer.
No, it's great. In the poem The Wax Ceremony, as when the speaker says about the protagonist, that the woman can't begin to write about this, and this is referring to the tragedy of Holodomor.
Mm-hmm.
I think I might be butchering the pronunciation a little bit. And which literally means, like, murder by hunger. And I was wondering if that was in part, like, if that would describe your struggle with the book and its content, your struggle to even begin to write about these huge events and these tragedies. And
yeah, with which you have no experience.
Yeah.
And you really, yeah. I found it nearly impossible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's, it's just so hard. It's just so hard to deal with. And I think, yeah, there's a lot of information out there about Holodomor. There are some websites. There are accounts on YouTube. Some of the poems in this book, like the Breadbasket of Europe, which talks a little bit about that tragedy. And it's just about impossible to watch. It's just unbelievable that, and of course, this type of thing is still going on, right? People are starving, and it's a terrible, terrible way to die. So, you know, you think about where you live here in Canada and how fortunate you are. And there's quite a helpless feeling as well. You're like, well, I'm me, and, you know, I'm not a particularly powerful person. I'm not a particularly rich person. I'm not particularly anyone. You know, what are you supposed to do in the face of such horror?
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, the poem in the book Holodomor here, which is, of course, it's just a blank page. I think that says a lot to me about that helplessness, and also it says a lot about the fact that not only is it difficult to talk about that kind of stuff, a lot of people were not permitted to talk about that kind of stuff. You know, so, you know, there's that weird place too where you're like, okay, yeah, I do have this fortunate life and I have the freedom to write anything I like. That is also a tremendous privilege and responsibility that if you are fortunate enough to be in a position where people will read your work, you should really think about what you have to say on occasion. So yeah, was it hard to write about? Yes, super hard to write about. People should look up those YouTube videos. Mm-hmm.
So I was wondering, to what extent would you, like, consider God of Misconnections to be of a political nature? Because you talk a lot about you know, the depleted uranium weaponry that is used by U.S. forces in Iraq now, and you liken, like, the effects to Chernobyl. You talk about, like, environmental catastrophes and AIDS and the poem Celebration. And in the poem of Goddess of Incongruity, it begins with the line, "All our lives we've known the atomic bomb, but that's okay, we've got these sedans." Great line.
Thank you very much.
Would you consider the book to be of a political nature at all, or, like, have political messages? And...
Okay, well, I'm not a particularly political person, although it may appear that way. I'm a writer.
Yeah.
So what I do is I just, I look out there and I respond to what I see, and this is the material of my life right now. These are the media that I'm coming up against. This is the images that I see when I look outside my window. I'm always considering where I am as an individual and how that, you know, how I fit in, and do, you know, does that even matter, and all these types of questions. So I think the politicizing of work actually tells me a lot about readers again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because writing is a funny thing. It doesn't really exist until it's out in the air, until other people have something to say about it. So many books just disappear, which, again, this might be a misconnection. Maybe this book will disappear too. We don't know. But yeah, I guess I'm interested in that kind of stuff. So is it a political book? Maybe. I mean, I'll put it to a maybe.
So, well, like, just in general, what role do you think art plays in politics? Like, how much of a say do you think writers or artists have?
Very little.
Very little.
I think writers and artists have very little to say in a political arena. I think that writers and artists are consistently marginalized in a political sense. I think that particularly right now, it's not a very great time to be a writer or an artist in Canada. It's very tenuous. So, but then you have to return back to the to the question about people who can't write at all, who can't say at all what they would like to say. So, you know, we're a very fortunate bunch as well. So we need to keep that in mind.
Yeah.
Also, but I really don't think that to write. A book with a political agenda seems to be not out of the question, but I guess politics change, and good writing doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Our readings of it can change, but, you know, the thing itself, if it's any good, will last, I think. Yeah.
And did you have, an intended audience for the book, or just put it out there?
I have an audience of one, and that is my sister.
You dedicated the first poem of the book to her, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Really? I know that sounds crazy, but I write a lot of my stuff for my sister, and I think the reason why I think of her, so maybe she's, like, the muse, right?
Mm-hmm.
She's my muse. I think of her because, you know, especially with this particular book, there were so many stories that I wanted her to know. You know, I wanted her to know about, all of this, the whole subject. I wanted her to know about it. So in a way, I guess I'm kind of writing for myself as well, through my sister. I think it's important, like, because I always remember that, you know, in the best of all possible worlds, we have an audience.
Mm-hmm.
So as long as I can, and, you know, imagine saying stuff to my sister, someone's receiving it, right? Someone's receiving the information. And it's important to me that she understands what it is that I'm talking about. So if I can imagine my sister going, like, what? What do you mean? Then I always rethink the way I've said something. Yeah. My sister's a very intelligent, smart, beautiful, talented young lady. So I figure she's perfect audience.
It's quite a compliment.
Well, she's all that.
I read somewhere in an interview that you were thinking about turning the wax ceremony into a film. Yeah, so do you want to tell me a little bit about those plans?
I would love to turn the wax ceremony into a film. I think it would be a pretty effective film. Just not a long thing, not, you know, not a full-length feature or anything, but just like a small something. I love film, and the images in that poem really, they are really alive for me. So, I don't know, I'm still trying to figure out how that would happen. I'm not a filmmaker. Mm-hmm. I'm not talented in that way. I'd really need to work with some people, and I don't know who that could possibly be, because I don't know anyone who works in film. I know some actors and actresses. I could maybe get them to be in it. But, yeah, I don't have any connections in that way, so.
What do you think it is about that poem in particular that lends itself to the medium of film?
I just have the first image so emblazoned in my brain. It's just this young woman. Actually, it's a specific young woman. It's Sophie Caird in Montreal. She's this very striking-looking young lady with long dark hair, and I can just see her in this ridiculous sort of costume, you know, the very, well, it's not ridiculous, it's just very traditional, you know, the traditional Ukrainian costume, dance costume, and, you know, she totters up to the camera in now here's the ridiculous part, the high heels, because of course in Eastern Europe the women all wear mm-hmm. insane footwear, which I love, and so she totters up to the camera, and then she just starts putting her lipstick on as if the camera is the mirror. Mm-hmm. It's a very bright red lipstick, and so I'm like, that's the opening of the film. And then I want the rest of it to just go from there. I think it would be fun. So I guess that's the image that I want first. I'm getting distracted. I'm so distracted. Yeah.
So what projects are you working on currently?
Sweet Bupkis. Sweet nothing. Because I am exhausted.
Yeah.
I'm so tired. Yeah, this book just came out 4 weeks ago, I think. And I've been touring it. I've been teaching mm-hmm. all this last semester, quite a lot of classes. So I do have some time off this summer. So I'm gonna do a lot of reading, I think, and try and get some writing done. But yeah, of course I say nothing, and then poems just happen. So we'll see.
Are you interested in working with any other genres?
Well, yes, film.
Film, yeah.
Yeah, but also I think that what I'll do is I'll try and rewrite The Wax Ceremony as fiction mm-hmm. And see what that looks like. I'm not a terribly gifted fiction writer, but I do like to try. And so, yeah, I'm going to rewrite it as a short story. That's my project for the summer. And then maybe that will make the film clearer. Yeah.
That's great. Well, is there anything you'd like to add that I maybe forgot to ask?
Oh, I don't think so. This is quite a delightful interview. Thank you very much for
thank you for coming.